Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour, with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
Tonight's meal, tilapia surprise with boiled cabbage. Begin cooking steps 1 through 50 now.
Are you kidding me? Making dinner shouldn't feel like doing a 1,000-piece puzzle. With Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals, the hard part's already done. Pre-chopped ingredients, zero stress. Just assemble, bake, and enjoy. No complicated steps, no mountain of dishes. Try assemble and bake today. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
It's 6:14. Dave put his time in, but Dave was the one telling you that they have a dense fog advisory in effect, and in certain areas, it's hard for the National Weather Service to tell where it is. So the best I can tell you is, if you get some fog, slow down, be careful. Don't use the flashers unless you're stopped. That's what the state law says, and obviously you're going to want to have your headlights on because it's, you know, still dark outside. Otherwise, maybe a chance for showers today and tomorrow. Then a cool front comes through on Wednesday, and we're going to have a little bitty taste of fall on Thursday. Sunny, less humid, highs around 87, but lows, North Shore in the 50s, South Shore in the 60s. So we'll get a little taste of what hopefully will be an early fall here in the city and the area. Mark Hamrick joins us now, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, to talk about the job numbers or lack thereof. How you doing, Mark?
Doing well, my friend. Good to be with you, Tommy.
Thanks for taking the time. Tell me about the September jobs report and how important it is and the fact that we don't have it. What does that mean?
Mm-hmm. With the federal government shutdown, Tommy, we don't get the regular federal statistical data that we have come to rely on, really take for granted. And this is quite inopportune timing in the sense of the job market is seen as essentially at something akin to a standstill at the moment. Remember, going back to June, we had a decline of 13,000 jobs reported by the Labor Department upon revision. And then in July, we added only 79,000 jobs, August adding only 22,000. What happened in September? Well, in terms of the federal government's reply, we don't know yet. And so we do get other data from the private sector. ADP, the private payrolls processor, told us they had a contraction of 32,000 jobs. And of course, we would have had three economic reports released last week, construction spending last Wednesday, the weekly jobless claims or new applications for unemployment benefits on Thursday. And then as you asked about the employment situation on Friday, which also gives us the unemployment rate most recently at 4.3%. So we all are reliant on this data because we need to make the best decisions we can on our personal finances. Business leaders need the data. Policymakers need it, including the Federal Reserve. And it's another unintended casualty of the inability of our elected officials to do the bare minimum to help the American people.
How accurate is the data? Because it seems like they release it, then we see revisions.
I would say it's quite accurate, but the revisions are the result of getting new information over time. And so the palpable example of that is that there are two components of the survey, or there are actually two surveys. One is the so-called establishment survey. That's the survey of employers that gives us that payrolls number, how many jobs were added or lost. And employers have to respond to that data. And the collection, by the way, is done around the 12th of the month. Mm-hmm. For this month, that's now 5 days away. Over time, more employers respond and we get more information. That's why those revisions occur. So there's nothing nefarious here, but we would always welcome an improvement in the process or the quality. And we do get improvement over time as we get more information.
If you can, Mark, take it down to the street level a little bit, if you will, and for the average guy or woman going to work this morning trying to understand how this relates to them, who looks at these numbers and how do they use these numbers to determine what exactly?
Sure. Well, if you're going to work this morning, as you mentioned there, Tommy, that's the crux of the issue. Do you have a job to go to? Do you have job security? And you know, for years, as I've monitored and analyzed this data, it does tend to be the most important economic report of the month when we're talking about the employment report. Mm-hmm. And so unless we're trust fund children, I'm not. anyone listening, you tell me. We're reliant on our income or the money that our family has or that our household has for the quality of our living. And so if we have very poor employment prospects, such as what occurs during a recession, and we've had a few of the doozies of those over the years, then that is instructive. And when the job market is firm or red hot, as it was a couple of years ago, that's instructive as well. I'll give you another example. The Labor Department earlier last week, before the shutdown, told us about job openings. And we now have one job open for every unemployed job seeker. In 2022, when the job market was regarded as quite strong, there were two jobs open for every unemployed job seeker. So that tells you about the way the job market has not evolved, but essentially settled back into a rhythm that is less than providing reason for comfort.
I get texts from people, and we have an Oakland Heart Jeweler talking text line 504-260-1870. I say that not that you're going to text, Mark, but so people understand they can text their questions in safely. No texting and driving ever, please, especially during a fog. But a couple of people actually are kind of hinting that there's something nefarious here going on. You used the word nefarious before, that somehow the government, they don't want these jobs. They don't want their job reports coming out because it's going to show that the economy is approaching stagflation. Let me take a break. You can address that when we come back. I just realized the time. 6:20, Mark Hamrick will address your text about stagflation, about the government hiding the numbers and shutting it down, et cetera, et cetera. When we return right now, time for traffic, WWL. 6:25, Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with our friend Mark Hamrick, Bankrate Senior Economic Analyst, talking about the job numbers that are not available because of the government shutdown. Somebody texted in before the break about something afoot where the government didn't want these numbers to come out, that we're approaching stagflation. And I guess we should start, Mark, with your explaining what stagflation is for those that were not around during the hellish days, the hellacious days, I guess, of what, the 70s or the 80s? When was stagflation?
It was both. It was the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay, so tell us what that is, and is there anything going on here that would indicate we're approaching stagflation?
First of all, there's not a precise definition for it, and that's part of the problem in using the word. But okay, what it aims to get at, and we're not experiencing the 70s, 80s version of it, is where you have virtually no economic growth and you do have a sharp rise in prices. The inflation that we're experiencing right now is not of the order that we had back then, but it's bad enough, and it's still essentially the number one economic complaint of virtually all Americans who are asked the question, you know, what is the economic ill that is a problem for you? And similarly, we continue to enjoy at least some economic growth. And so I would say that The combination of slowing growth or slower growth and rising prices is definitely a feature, not a bug, of the current economy. I have trouble using that word because the standard that was seen in the 1970s and the early 1980s was more severe and lacking a precise definition for it. And Tommy, you know me, to be someone who tells you what I know and not to rely on what I might think, I don't feel like we fit that definition.
Well, let me ask you this. Having gone through it, can we call it hellflation?
Why not? Why don't we coin that? You and I will make T-shirts, and then we'll figure out what yacht we're going to buy after
Tim, get the Secretary of State online. Put a mark on that, please. Hellflation. Mark and I want to own that. Let's talk about the timing of this. Why is it so bad with the government shutdown, both in terms of numbers and what's going on in the economy?
The reason is primarily because right now the economy is going through a very unusual experience, and that is the things that we just now talked about, that the job market is cooling. There is a higher risk of recession right now. We just queried economists on that question for our Bankrate Quarterly Economic Survey, and they do say that the chances of a recession over the next year are close to 4 in 10. That's higher than would typically be the case, not the highest that we've seen in the last few years. So, for example, we all need to make decisions about, are we going to spend? Are we going to buy something that might cost a lot that may or may not be discretionary? Business leaders need to hire. Many are opting not to right now. We have a Federal Reserve meeting at the end of the month, and they're going to have to make a decision one way or the other what to do with interest rates, but they're going to be lacking unless we get this shutdown resolved soon. A lot of the data they would typically have. They will have plenty of data, and they will make a decision.
Does anybody benefit by these numbers not being available politically?
I don't really think so, because number one, the data will eventually come out. We have private sector data that tells us the story in other ways. And so, you know, maybe there are some investors out there of a very sophisticated nature who can benefit by making the right bet on how the performance of a given company or the broadly speaking, the economy may unfold. But no, I think if anything, it is a very unproductive process. And by the way, it wastes taxpayers' money by magnitudes that are just unacceptable. Palpable example of that is that some of the hundreds of thousands of federal workers who are affected by this, those who are on furlough and not deemed to be critically important, are basically paid to do nothing. And so when they are eventually paid, they'll get money, but they won't have been at work.
They've never not, pardon the double negative, but they never not received back pay, correct?
It's federal law now. They have to be paid.
They have to be paid. Okay, so there you go. It's free vacation is what it is, although a low cash flow issue. October 7th, you got Christmas coming up. Does the timing have anything to do with, will that affect the holidays at all, or what people decide how much they're going to spend?
Our Bankrate survey has indicated people are going to begin their holiday shopping earlier rather than later, but I guarantee you this is going to weigh on consumer confidence when we get the next round of reports on that.
Well, I'm still going to get you a Hellflation T-shirt, Mark. Don't worry about it, okay?
God bless you, my friend.
You bet. Thank you. I appreciate your time. We'll take a break, come back, talk to David Schultz about the Supreme Court and what they're going to be looking at on this first Tuesday of October. Yesterday, they got back in session. It was the first Monday in October. 6:30, time now, WWL First News. All right, 6:44, 16 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by David Schultz, professor of public political science and law at Hamline University. How you doing, David?
I am doing well, and I hope you are too.
I am, sir. First Tuesday in October, which means the Supreme Court has been at it for a day. Not that they've ever really gotten away from it. Tell me, first off, before we get into the Supreme Court, the president's talking about invoking the Insurrection Act when it comes to Portland and saying that Portland's on fire. I've never been in Portland. I have no earthly idea if it's on fire or not. The mayor and the governor says this is one block that we're talking about here, not the entire area. Tell me what the Insurrection Act is and what it means that the president could do here.
Well, first off, we have to talk about another act, and this is the Posse Comitatus Act from the, I think, 1878, which bars the use of policing, bars the use of military for domestic policing in the United States. And that's posing to be a limitation upon his ability to be able to deploy the troops the way he wants to do so. However, there's an earlier act, and I'm forgetting the exact date, early 19th century, in which it's called the Insurrection Act, which gives the President of the United States the authority to declare an insurrection and to bring out the military for the purposes of peacekeeping, more or less what you call policing. And so what he's thinking of trying to do is to do a, I'm not sure what word I want to call it here, invoke a different power to say that now you're going to use the Insurrection Act as the basis of my authority. And so what he would do first is declare an emergency and say, to use your words or his words, there's a fire going on in Portland. I need to bring in the National Guard. Therefore, I'm going to invoke the Insurrection Act to give me the authority to do that.
So what is the history of the Insurrection Act?
Well, the Insurrection Act is really clearly for much more of, I want to say it gets us to more or less occupations, you know, occupation by the United States of foreign troops and by, real serious conflict. I mean, it's rarely, and I can't think of the last time it was actually invoked in the United States. Mm-hmm. Now, someone will probably call in and remind me of when it was or something, but it's used incredibly rarely. And I'm going to say it's really war and peace type of issues.
So, meaning in times of war, if I would say 9/11, that kind of thing, or almost.
Yeah, it would be something at that level. In terms of what would be invoked, I think there might have. I can't remember now if during the Rodney King riots back in the 90s. And again, I may be off on this one because it might be something like that where we just had significant looting, burning, and so forth like that. But for the most part, again, if I can put it in terms of war and peace types of issues, at least that was the intent of Congress when they adopted it. When it's we really have widespread disorder, and it's not clear at all that that normal domestic policing can address those issues.
So
it's also an act. I was gonna say it's also an act that was adopted at the time before we really had the establishment of modern policing, because modern policing in this country really doesn't date till post Civil War. So it's an act that really comes out of a different context and a different set of purposes.
So according to Newsweek, Dwight Eisenhower used it in 57 to desegregate schools in Arkansas.
Okay.
Lyndon Johnson used it after the assassination of Martin Luther King, and George W. Bush used it during the 1992 Los Angeles riots following the Rodney King verdict. So here's my issue. I don't care if it's Donald Trump or whomever the president happens to be, Barack Obama, pick somebody. The definition between political protest and insurrection, because if the president, whomever the president happens to be, can use the Insurrection Act to quell protest because they deem it insurrection, well, that's a fine line we're walking there, right, in this country? Correct me if I'm wrong.
We are absolutely correct in terms of that, because even though we might think that walking across the Edmund Pettus Bridge, i.e. Martin Luther King back in the 60s, is a peaceful protest, talk to a bunch of people who are saying that we have lawlessness, we have disorder, we have people who are going to be breaking the law. We need to crush this or clamp down on it. It leaves too much discretion, and if we to the President of the United States, whoever it may be, and if we think our law is all about is trying to limit discretion, arbitrary discretion, and prevent the abuse of that discretion. And the whole purpose of the First Amendment, in part, is to say that we're not going to let government officials get to use their discretion regarding what type of action or speech they like or dislike.
So when it comes to insurrection, somebody texted in, I'm just repeating the text, and I think they make a good point, because I know what I saw on January 6th. That to me was an insurrection. That to me is a situation where maybe whomever the president was at the time could have called out federal troops and said, no, we got to protect the federal government. Wrong?
It sort of looks like if you're assaulting the U.S. Capitol or storming the U.S. Capitol, that gets pretty high up on my list of things that would look like an insurrection when that when we have people storming into the Capitol, and if the accounts are correct here, you know, we had members of Congress who felt personally threatened. If I remember correctly, didn't we have at least one guard at the U.S. Capitol who died as a result? I'm trying to remember now. But the point being is that we had people who were assaulted, government property, the very heart of our government under siege. That looks like an insurrection to me.
Well, now we're going to go down a rabbit hole because people say that FBI agents were there that started the protest, which makes no sense because then I don't understand exactly where that conspiracy theory goes, but people can believe whatever they want. Let me take a break. We come back. I want to talk about what the Supreme Court's going to look at this session as it relates to presidential powers. And I would just ask the audience at 504-260-1870, you got to be careful what you ask for here, because what could be viewed as violence, a violent protest against this today, maybe you don't like what the president does tomorrow, then all of a sudden. And real quick, David, somebody's talking about are we talking about National Guard troops or like U.S. Marines or Army, et cetera?
The insurrection gives the president broad leeway, not just in terms of National Guard, but potentially U.S. troops.
Thank you. We'll take a break, pick it up. We come back. Traffic now, WWL. 7.5, Tommy Tucker, WWL. I'm getting a lot of texts here, but I sense they're from the same people that were texting me back in the day that would say, after 9-11, that said, those who would surrender liberty for security deserve neither. But now all of a sudden it seems as though they're willing to surrender liberty for security in Portland, Oregon, or wherever it happens to be. Tell me what the Supreme Court is likely to look at this session. David Schultz, professor of political science and law at Hamline University.
Well, somebody asked me a question yesterday, one of my students, what do I think is the most important case on the Supreme Court docket right now? And I said, it's going to be clearly all about Trump's powers, because so far the Supreme Court has avoided directly confronting a lot of the things that Trump is doing, such as what maybe invoking the Insurrection Act, or a variety of other things. But I think the single most important case, or a couple of cases here, is going to address the ability of Donald Trump to be able to impose tariffs by himself. There's a law that basically Congress had adopted many, many years ago that outlines under what situations tariffs can be imposed, and the lower courts have been consistently ruling against them. So I put that at the top of the list. And I say that because that's a case that I think literally hits the pocketbook for just about everybody, you know, in the country in terms of that. So that goes at the top of my list. There's some more cases about about transgender rights that are going to be appearing out there in terms of important cases, which I think, again, for a lot of population, that's going to be important. But I would sort of focus on maybe those are the two areas, and certainly there are a lot of other important cases out there, but the case, I think, is the one that's probably going to be the closest, near and dearest to many people's hearts.
All the president's doing, in fairness, is doing what, I don't mean disrespectful here at all, but like a dog would do with a leash or whatever, he's just going as far as he'll go, right? I mean, as far as the courts will let him go?
As far as Congress and the courts will
go. Congress and the courts will let him go.
Yeah. One of the things we keep forgetting here is that the whole concept of checks and balances and separation of powers requires Congress to also do its job, too. And whether you like the president or dislike the president, what he's doing here, at some point, Congress is expected to do its job. And because Congress has pretty much following the line of what Trump wants.
Thank you, David. It is Tuesday morning, October 7th. Some fog around. Be aware of that. But the good news is the cool front's coming in by Thursday, and this could feel a lot better come Friday. Glenn Gentry joins us now, interim research director at the LSU Ag Center, to talk about feral hogs. How you doing, Glenn?
Doing good this morning. How are you?
I'm all right, sir. Tell me how big of a problem feral hogs are, and where did they come from? How did we get to here?
Well, the hogs, basically, population has been increasing over the years. When we started our projects probably a decade ago, Wildlife and Fisheries estimated there was about 600,000 pigs in Louisiana, and that number's increased to about 1 million over the last 10 years. And they wreak havoc, basically, on agronomic crops and are starting to move into cities and towns across the state. They're not native. Pigs are not native to North America, so they were brought in early on by DeSoto and explored as a food source and released on the landscape. So that's how they were initially deposited here. But as they got out, they're very opportunistic. They'll eat anything, can survive just about anywhere. And then people started hunting pigs. And when they started hunting pigs, there was a big problem with the transportation of pigs from one site to another and release for hunting, which caused us to get to where we are today.
Wait, so people like basically wanted the pigs to expand so they could hunt them, and then they caused their own problem?
That is correct. That is correct. That's why about 4 or 5 years ago, there was some laws passed in Louisiana where feral pigs could not be transported unless it was going to a slaughter facility.
So, go ahead. Well, no, I was going to ask you, are these things tasty? Can you eat them?
Oh, yeah, you can eat them. They're good. They taste good. The problem is their reproductive rate is so high, you can't control them with just hunting. And so once you deposit a few in one spot, it doesn't take them long to overwhelm the food sources in that area, and then they just move on. They're very nomadic.
So how bad is it getting in terms of urban areas? Because you said they're starting to expand, right?
Yes, they're starting to expand. So, you know, in 2016, I think there was a study that came out that showed where pig populations were. And they basically showed that they could increase in numbers in the southeast up the eastern coast and also increase in numbers up the western coast. So as these pigs...
Wait, eastern coast of Louisiana or...
Oh, eastern coast of the United States,
okay.
And the western coast of the United States. So the population is not through spreading, basically. There's areas that can contribute to pigs' well-being. And in some areas where they're not supposed to be, we have populations, which, as we talked about earlier, were transported by people. So these things carry zoonotic diseases, which are diseases that can be transferred from animals to humans. Mm-hmm. And we have a researcher, Mike Caller, who did some work in state parks in Louisiana and actually found some of these in some of the water sources at these state parks.
So if you can eat them, and they have a lot of hungry people in the nation, it would seem like that'd be a problem that would pretty well solve itself if you could manage to harvest these things and then process them and get them to the people that are hungry. Am I making it far too simple, Glenn?
Well, kind of. Okay. The Wildlife and Fisheries did a study down at the mouth of the river on a hunting preserve down there. And on one side of the river, they had pig populations, and they allowed people to hunt. And basically, I think if I remember the study correctly, they would average about a pig a day. People would come in, shoot pigs. So some days you got more pigs, some days you got less. On the other side of the river, they went in with airboats and helicopters and really worked them over pretty good. And what they found was on the side where the hunters were just hunting, pig numbers increased, damaged areas increased. You just really can't kill enough of them. With their reproductive rate, you have to kill 70 to 75% just to hold numbers where they are. So if we've got 1 million pigs in Louisiana, just to keep those numbers where they are, you got to kill 700,000. And we're nowhere near to that number.
How easy are they to harvest? Are they hard to get?
Oh, yeah. They're smart. They're one of the smartest creatures that walk the earth. Mm. They learn. They go nocturnal. And they learn patterns, so they're not real easy to kill, but it can be done. And I'm by no means am saying we shouldn't hunt them, because any pressure we put on that population is a good thing.
What you're saying is you can't hunt your way out of the problem, right?
That's correct. That is absolutely correct.
You said they worked them over pretty good. Would you go so far as to say gave them the business?
That's right. Gave them the business.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let me take a break. We'll talk about this bait giving them the business. And has anything changed? I know we talked to you a while back about getting a patent for the hog bait. Has anything changed since then? Because how big do these things get, Glenn?
Oh, but you have pigs up 400, 500, 600-pound boars.
Wow.
You know, most of them aren't that large. I mean, the sows are running 200 or 300 pounds. But you can have some rather large boars that show up.
How high at the shoulder? We're talking like a German Shepherd or something like that, or bigger than that?
A little taller probably than a German Shepherd.
Wow.
Yeah, a little bigger than a German Shepherd.
And can
like a calf, a little bigger than a medium-sized calf.
A medium-sized what?
A medium-sized calf.
A calf. I got you. Calf. Wow. So are they dangerous?
Oh, yes. Uh-oh. Yes, they are, especially the sows when they have piglets. If an individual happens to find themselves in between a sow and her piglets, she'll go to protect those piglets. Probably 7 or 8 years ago, there was a woman in Texas that was actually killed by a sow in a neighborhood. She showed up. She was sitting with an elderly couple. It was before daylight. They think she got out of her car and got between the sow and piglets, and the sow basically killed her. So, yes, they are very dangerous.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking about feral pigs in Louisiana. Glenn Gentry, our guest, interim research director at the LSU Ag Center. You can't hunt your way out the problem. We'll talk about these baits when we return. Traffic now, WWL. I 727, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Somebody texted in, Sarah, two types of landowners in Louisiana, those that have feral hogs or those that will have feral hogs. Is that accurate, Glenn?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Absolutely. Yes.
So tell me about these baits, because if you can't hunt your way out of the problem, I guess you can't trap your way out of the problem either?
You know, all those things help, but we're going to have a multitude of things in the toolbox to try to help control the population. And one of the things that we were looking at was the sodium nitrite toxicant. And that's what kind of got us on this track. Mm-hmm. And the sodium nitrite is basically used in human food as a preservative. Mm-hmm. And so the FDA says humans can consume up to 200 parts per million in a finished human product. When we did our studies with pigs, the LD90 level, or the level of sodium nitrite that took to kill 90% of our population, came out to be 189 parts per million. So it takes less to kill a hog than what humans can consume in a finished human product. And what it basically does is it changes the composition of the blood, and it can't carry oxygen in the pig, and it's very easy to push them over. And basically, over the edge, they basically just lay down and go to sleep and don't get back up.
So it seems like you're taking the first step toward curing the meat, are you?
That's correct. Absolutely. So people have asked me if we just feed them bacon, would that work? Well, they'd have to eat a fair amount of bacon to get to that point.
But, yeah, plus it'd be awkward, you know what I'm saying?
It would be very awkward.
For them. So if, I don't know what people should do if they encounter a pig, what should they do?
Back away. Basically, slowly. You certainly don't want to get between a sow and her piglets, as I said earlier. They're very protective of those piglets, and it can turn out bad for the human for sure.
So the likelihood of somebody in a suburban area finding one of these things in their backyard is what? Very likely or not? As likely as a coyote? Less so? Do coyotes hunt them?
No, coyotes don't hunt them. Basically, the only predator that pigs have are humans. Mm. So probably bears to some degree. Mm-hmm. But I would think the likelihood of encountering one at this point in time is relatively low. We do have them. They've trapped them in New Orleans. They've trapped them in the park down there in New Orleans before. So they do spread, and especially in Louisiana where you have these storms come in, pushes water in and pushes the pigs out of their natural habitat, you can run into situations like that.
So I live in Belchase. If I stumble upon a feral hog and I dispatch it, can I eat the meat or not?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Make sure you cook it very well, though.
All right, and you got to render it first and all that stuff, right, and field dress
right.
And everything else?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Hey, thank you, Glenn. I appreciate it. A pleasure as always. Good luck. I hope we make some progress in this feral pig thing. When we come back, we'll talk about negative campaigns. Ed Chervenak, professor of political science at UNO, as we reach the home stretch of the mayoral race in the October election, primary at least. Tommy Tucker back in a flash right now. Time for WWL First News. For that, we go to UNO's in. 7:46, 14 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, getting ready to talk to Ed Chervenak, professor of political science at my alma mater, UNO. And I would ask you to text me here at 504-260-1870. No texting and driving ever, especially with the fog in the area. But I'll read some of your text. And I'd like to know your view on negative campaigning. And everybody says they hate it, but it must work because people do it. So I'd like to know if a negative campaign has ever moved you one way or the other. Or maybe it's moved you toward the candidate that is being attacked. Because sometimes it can have that effect. I know I saw a couple of things. I don't know if I should say it or not, because I don't want to give anybody publicity, but alleging racism, I guess in a way, or bias, maybe not racism, but bias when it comes to contracting on the part of one candidate and something else. I just saw a reference to
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk. Crazy weather we're having. No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3-month plan. $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer. First 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
To remind you that 60% of sales on Amazon come from independent sellers, here's John from Devil Dog Pet Company.
We run our family business from Sterling Heights, Michigan, but we can reach customers all over the country thanks to Amazon. Good boy.
Shop small business on Amazon.
Tonight's meal, tilapia surprise with boiled cabbage. Begin cooking steps 1 through 50 now.
Are you kidding me? Making dinner shouldn't feel like doing a 1,000-piece puzzle. With Blue Apron's new one-pan assemble and bake meals, the hard part's already done. Pre-chopped ingredients, zero stress. Just assemble, bake, and enjoy. No complicated steps, no mountain of dishes. Try assemble and bake today. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
A clerk of court race where apparently somebody's attacking somebody else, and then you got all kind of endorsements that are being handed out by some federal officials and so forth. So tell me really, please, if you can, at 504-260-1870, how you go about deciding upon whom to vote, for whom to vote. And does negative campaigning ever sway you one way or the other? A text comes in and says, negative campaigning inevitably sways me toward the candidate that's being attacked, because I figure the person that is paying for the negative campaign themselves have something to hide. And rather than touting their own experience or their own ideas, they're just trying to tear the other person down. And that's a good point, because tearing somebody else down doesn't make you better yet. Make you better, right? Somebody else texted in and said that I have never in my life paid attention to an endorsement. Again, if anything, endorsements make me go the other way, especially if it's from a candidate or an elected official that I don't like. Somebody else texting in and said negative campaigning shows that a candidate cannot defend their own views, which is interesting. And when it comes to deciding for whom you vote, somebody texted in and said they try to do their due diligence, but all it does is make them more confused. So ultimately, they go to name recognition and past history. Somebody else texted in and said, I loathed Donald Trump until the media started lying about him and I did my own research. So again, it goes to research, and where do you get your research? 7:50, 10 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 7:55, 5 till 8, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Kevin Gilmore from the National Weather Service. Talk about the approaching cool front. How are we calling it, Kevin? What are we referring to it as, a dry front?
Yeah, we can call it a cool or a dry front. Either way we look at it, it's going to be a little bit of a change than what we've been seeing lately. So maybe some lower humidity, too. So a welcome feel for a lot of us who've been dealing with this heat lately.
Let's talk about the fog. What's the situation with that and the likelihood of we're going to have more fog tomorrow?
It's looking like primarily just a deal we're going to be having to deal with today. This is from a lot of that precipitation we saw yesterday that fell across the area. And it's very humid out. If you haven't been outside yet, it's very humid. So it's got that feel to the air. We got some patchy areas of fog already across the area, but it won't last long. It'll burn off once the sun rises. And we shouldn't be really expecting any type of additional dense fog issues to the rest of the week.
And that's a function of the rain that we got?
Yeah, when the rain falls. Exactly. When the rain falls, it really saturates the soils. And if it's really humid like that, it kind of adds to the process of making the fog at the surface. Something we typically see this time of year is something where we have this rain that falls and the fog kind of comes from that. It's not technically really in the fog season yet. However, can't rule it out this time of year, especially when we get a real big heavy rain event like we got yesterday for some areas.
Tell me about what's going on with the tropics and the rest of hurricane season. I know it's October 7th. I always look for the all clear for the next 7 to 10 days. If you can give me that, that'll take us to October 17th, maybe?
Yeah, it looks like it. Right now, we do have one system we're monitoring in the central Atlantic. It has a 90% chance of formation in the next few days. If it does get a name, it's going to be Jerry. And so far, indications are that it will form, and when it does, it'll recurve off to the well far away from the Atlantic coastline. There's also one other weaker disturbance in the southern Gulf that is heading towards Mexico. It's not going to be any problem or any issue for us here for the next 7 days.
So we're clear until October 14th at least?
At least, yeah. And that pattern's looking like this. See, we're going to get a front later this week, and that's good news. That type of pattern's kind of pushing these storms away from the U.S. mainland. It's making them recurve. So if we can just keep this pattern going here for the next few weeks, we'll be in the clear. But we still have a little bit more of the season to go through. Season goes all the way through November 30th, so we'll be keeping an eye on it here for the next few weeks.
What is it that has been causing all these storms to curve way up in the Atlantic and go to the away from the United States? Do you know?
Yeah, we had a little bit of a progressive pattern, and what I mean by that is a lot more fronts that are diving across the central and eastern U.S., and that's introduced a lot drier air, cooler air sometimes across the U.S., and that type of upper air pattern, that northwest to southeast flow, has a tendency to kind of recurve the storms off. So if we can get that pattern going, we can get these systems to kind of more eject off towards the north central Atlantic to the northern Atlantic, and then recurve off away from the mainland. So it's a good weather pattern for us, but again, still, we're going to have to keep an eye on it.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, Kevin Gilmore, National Weather Service. And what kind of cool temperatures are we looking for this weekend?
Yeah, we're going to be getting down to the upper 60s, possibly mid to upper 60s for lows Friday when we get into the early parts of the weekend. So it's going to definitely feel a little bit cooler for some people. So we're heading right there. We're heading straight to fall. It's going to be here before you know it.
And what about beyond that? Can you see anything coming beyond that, or it's too early?
Too early to see beyond that. Really, it could be really anywhere we get 5 to 7 days from now. But really, it's looking dry also. No big rain chances over the next 5 to 7 days. So we'll enjoy this nice weather while we have it.
And get the car washed. Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. Kevin Gilmore with the National Weather Service, 759. Some of the texts coming in. I don't know what to believe anymore when it comes to picking a candidate. It's hard to pick one. I know what I want now, but I change, they change, and times change. That's interesting. Somebody said I already voted. I always vote early, so last-minute ads can't change my mind. Somebody else said negative ads are the only way you get the truth. That's interesting. And then somebody else says, I don't vote. They're all liars and thieves, which reminds me of the quotes, what is it that you get the government you deserve, right? And the other thing is that bad people are elected by good people who don't vote. So I don't know that not voting is an answer at all. But that it is an interesting text about, you know what you want now, and you know what they say now, but the times change, they change, and you change. So it's kind of like hard to predict the future. Jeff Nowak joins us. We come back. We'll talk about the Saints, and we'll talk about the Pelicans. So we'll have some fun when we return here on WWL. Ball's about 55 yards in the air, 8:15 now. Jeff Nowak joins us, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Jeff, I have been in the dome for a lot of long bombs, a lot of touchdowns by both sides, but that's one of the nicer ones I've ever seen. That was a thing of beauty, a joy forever. Tell me what it was like from the sideline watching it.
Yeah, well, it was a long time coming, right? Like, yeah. It feels like it's been forever since we've seen one of those, and definitely the Rashid Shaheed. You know, he got hurt midway through the season last year. Missed the final, 10 games. So, you know, we saw a few long touchdowns to MVS, but he just didn't have that vibe, right? you know, you see Rashid catch that ball, and there's really no question whether he's going to take it to the house or not. I think that's what makes it special, because you know he's got that speed, and we just haven't seen it. But no, that was big, and it was cool, not just because of the play, but also, you know, the moment it happened in the game. They're down 14-6 at that point. You know, if they're pinned back at their 13-yard line, if they go three and out there, give the ball back to the Giants, mm-hmm. you know, who knows the way the rest of that game goes. They would be in good field position. Then maybe they score. Maybe they go into halftime up 21-6 instead. You know, the whole stadium, which was, I would say, cautiously optimistic, right? There wasn't a ton of energy in that building over the first, I don't know, you know, 1.5 quarters of that game, just because it's like, oh, we've seen this movie before. Mm-hmm. Like, we feel good about it. Then suddenly, oh, the other team looks like the best offense in the NFL. The opposing quarterback is dicing us up. And then, you know, that everything kind of changed at that point, right?
Like, I tell you what,
Giants
it did.
Didn't score again.
It electrified the crowd is what it did.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what you want to see. That's what you expect to see in that building. And we just haven't seen it enough.
There's nothing more dramatic than watching that ball float in the air and looking at that receiver wide open and knowing something good's going to happen. And there is no substitute for speed in the NFL, is there?
No, and the Saints just haven't done a great job of using it over the first 4 weeks of the season, because it only takes one. Like, you don't have to be hitting bomb after bomb after bomb. One big touchdown, one big play, one explosive like that can change the entire momentum of a game, and it did.
Tell me about some other takeaways that you had after Sunday's game, Jeff.
Yeah, well, there are a few. You know, the Saints are not good enough in the red zone right now, you know, and there's a lot of positives that you can take out of that, particularly on the defensive side of the ball and being opportunistic and taking your advantage of the other team's mistakes, which they made plenty of them. But, you know, three trips into the red zone, zero touchdowns, like, that's not good enough. You know, in a lot of games, that's going to be the reason you look back and say, well, why didn't we win? Well, we left a lot of points on the board. And it's not all on Spencer Rattler. I thought Spencer played, when you look at the numbers, I thought Spencer played an outstanding game, considering he was pressured on 17 of his dropbacks. That's 53% of his dropbacks. He was not sacked in the game. That's the most pressures generated by any team in the NFL this year that didn't get a sack in the game. And that's the Giants' bread and butter, pressuring the quarterback, getting him to the ground. They weren't able to do it once. And a lot of that was on Spencer kind of creating and extending. And he's been so much better at that this year. It's the biggest point of growth for him. And so to me, it's like, okay, how do you get better in the red zone? We got to be able to run the ball in the red zone. You got to be able to get down to the low red zone and create from there, because when you're passing, like, you, every red zone trip is kind of treated the same, but it's a lot different when you're trying to score from the 18 or from the 12 than when you're trying to score from the 3. And the Saints just haven't gotten a lot of opportunities where you could feasibly run the ball into the end zone. So you're putting too much on the quarterback. You got to be better there. But you have to be happy with the young secondary, right? Like, that's mm-hmm. the biggest thing for me is you have – this was a season that we all kind of went in ready for, like, this is a take-your-medicine year. There's going to be a lot of frustrating moments, but you're building to something, right? You finally got that win in the column, that number in the win column, and you did it with, you know, a rookie outside corner, a second-year outside corner, a rookie safety, a third-year safety. Justin Reed went out with a concussion. He's in the concussion protocol. And that group, you know, did you see a ton of mistakes? Did you see a bunch of busted coverages? Did you see pass interference penalties? Like, no, that was on the Giants. They were the ones that did that.
Yep.
So I thought that was really cool. And that's just a positive thing. You know, in a 1-4 season, you want to be able to look at it and say, okay, but what are we building to? What are the kind of the kernels that we can add to and build around? And those young defensive secondary players were one of those things.
I said this yesterday on that flea flicker. I think it was Burgess closed like something from Top Gun. Didn't it look like it? Like it's a heat-seeking missile, man. It was like all of a sudden this guy's open, and no, he's not.
Well, what I appreciated about it was that he didn't play completely like a heat-seeking missile. It was more like, you know, like he found him, and then he didn't run through him.
Yes.
You see that play a lot. Like, he kind of got beat. The flea flicker worked. And the guy was wide open. Dart really, I mean, if he throws it where it should be, it's a touchdown. He underthrows it and gives Burgess a chance. And the biggest part of that play is he was under control. He recovered and he made a play on the ball, but he didn't just run through the guy for a penalty, which you see all the time
Absolutely.
In the NFL.
Poise.
So that was the big one for me. Yeah.
Did Kool-Aid turn a corner or not? What do you think?
Yeah, I think the analysis of young players always kind of bugs me because, like, it's a lot of times it's like either he had a good game or one bad play, you know, and it's like you every game, every NFL game, it's like, okay, you have like a good play, you have a bad play, you got to improve on the bad plays and increase the frequency of the good plays, and then you get to a level where, hey, you're a lockdown corner,
confidence.
He's a second year pro, so there's gonna be like, you got beat there, right? Like, there's gonna be moments, and those are the ones that are magnified, because when a cornerback plays perfect coverage, the ball doesn't get thrown at him and no one sees it.
Right.
Right? So it's easy to ignore all of the kind of, okay, he played that even or he won, and then, but he got beat deep on this play, so that's all we talked about. I think Kool-Aid has been kind of steadily improving. It's just nice for him to kind of have those signature moments. You know, even though the first career interception, I would argue, is like, maybe you just knocked that one down because it's a fourth down play and you're intercepting the ball 30 yards downfield.
Oh, yeah.
But – yeah, I'm not going to begrudge a guy getting his – it was his 10th career interception, I would be more critical. The first career interception, it's hard to ask a guy to knock that down. And plus, it was a really nice play by him. So.
Yeah, I got in an argument with some people about that because it's like, well, you basically gave him a punt, and then somebody else said, well, I've never seen him drop the ball in that situation. So anyway, we'll take a break, pick it up. We come back with Jeff Nowak, 822 Traffic Now, WWL. All right, 827, our news director, Dave Cohen's going to join us after the news at 830. But if you go to WWL.com right now, you'll be able to see some video Louisiana State Police have released that they say supports the charges against Kyron Lacy. And it is some video that I've not seen before that does indicate the way he was driving that could have caused the accident. So you can go to WWL.com. We'll talk to Dave Cohen about that as well. Jeff Nowak, I was talking about confidence with Kool-Aid McKinstry. You know, I was at the game on Sunday, and I don't know if this happens often or not, but I saw Blake Groupie out there while a halftime act was performing, kicking maybe 30-yard field goals, I guess, with his little thing, the little triangle deal they got to hold the football?
Yeah,
the tee, I guess, whatever you call it, yeah. Does that normally happen or not?
Yeah, the kickers will go out there prior to the start of the second half, To get some that
he was out there during a lot of the halftime show.
It's always more difficult for those guys in their routine when there is a halftime show, like an actual performance, because they kind of have to work around it. But no, that's normal. I don't know. It's tough for me to say whether he was getting in extra work. He is struggling right now, and that's a thing that's something the Saints have to really look at. I don't think they're considering making a change at this point. But you do have to start talking about it, like, okay, can he get this sorted out? Is it an issue? I mean, it's easy to gloss over the fact that he made four kicks in that game, one of which was 53. Like, you ask a guy to kick six times, the standard can't be either he makes all six or he's trash. Like, right. That's not
– But on a season, though, five –
Five misses.
Yeah.
Too many. He only had four misses all of last season. It's just not clicking for him. And the way he missed in that game is more concerning than – the fact that he missed, in that one was kind of a weird kind of hook that's just not something you see from him. And then the second one was kept out too far to the right, which to me indicates that he's trying to accommodate for that hook.
Just like golf.
And then he hit it straight. If you played golf, you understand, sometimes you miss because you hit it right where you're aiming, and that's what happened there. So you've got to figure that out.
That's why stroke and distance is so damaging, because you guess what? You got to stand up there and fix it real quick because you're hitting three off the tee.
Exactly.
I think he's not hurt, right, at all? As far as
that's
you know?
A good question, and you have to start to wonder, because a lot of his misses, the explanation is he just missed it. He mishit it. Like, and why would you be mishitting that consistently? I don't know. So I almost hope that's the case, because that would at least explain some of it. Otherwise, it's just a guy that has lost confidence, and that's not what you want to hear.
Well, but it can come back too. You know, I think in a way, I don't know, Jeff. I could make a case just the opposite, where I would prefer it's mental and not physical, so that maybe, you know, for whatever reason, just like golf, it starts clicking and you're in the groove again. Hey, thank you, man. Yeah. I appreciate it. You do a great job on the sideline. I appreciate your time today, Jeff Nowak, WWL Saints sideline reporter. Dave Cohen will join us when we come back, talk about the new video released by Louisiana State Police as it relates to Kyron Lacy. Right now, time for WWL First News. For that, we go to Ian Ozen. Thank you, Ian. 8:39, 21 till 9. Dave Cohen, our news director, joins us now. And Dave, this video that I just saw on WWL.com, tell us about the Kyron Lacy thing and the state police and what they've released.
Well, Louisiana State Police today, saying in an effort to be fully transparent, have released additional video, witness statements, additional reports, and what they say is all of the information related to the investigation into the crash in which Kyren Lacy, LSU superstar football player, was charged with negligent homicide. You recall that Matt Ory, the attorney for the Lacy family, had presented new video this week that he said showed that Lacy was more than 70 yards away from the crash at the time it occurred and suggested Lacy did not cause the crash. The video that you can now see, and we have his video there as well, but the new video today that we've gotten from Louisiana State Police now shows Lacy traveling at a high rate of speed in his green Dodge Charger, passing four vehicles on Highway 20 before suddenly slamming on the brakes and swerving back into his own lane seconds before the crash that occurs. In the witness statements, it's interesting to hear what the trooper found when he first got on the scene. Multiple people approached the state trooper who arrived to tell them that they needed to go find that green Charger that Lacy was driving because it caused the crash.
There was a green Charger that caused all this.
SRT8, he caused all of it. He went to pay the cars way back there, sir.
The green Charger collided with these cars?
He went around that truck. Okay.
He was passing up right now,
and she had no choice.
And in the video, you can see, and as you heard that witness say, she had no choice. In that video, you can see Lacy suddenly slam on the brakes, swerve back into his own lane right before the crash occurs. And what what the family attorney, Matt Ory, had said earlier was this was not Lacy's fault. He was blaming the driver of the other vehicle.
You watched a car chart coming at you in your lane of traffic, but you never thought to just tap the brakes? Really? No. Data is accurate. The black box is accurate that says that you never touched your brakes. You never touch your brakes in the last 5 seconds until 0.5 seconds before the impact. That's their data. It's not mine.
He told Homa TV that Lacy was still 72 yards away at that time and that she could have just stopped. She didn't have to swerve to avoid him. So what this really comes down to, and you can watch both videos at WWL.com, Tommy, is a question. Was Lacy being 72 yards away from this woman in oncoming traffic the reason she swerved and caused the deadly crash that left one man dead and several people wounded, or not? You can go watch both videos and make that determination for yourself.
The woman that swerved was in the opposite lane from the oncoming traffic, correct?
Yes. So Lacy was in her lane,
speeding, going like the video I saw, passing like four vehicles on a two-lane highway. So you got to
one lane each direction, double yellow line.
You see
in the middle.
A green Charger. I'm just going from a lady's perspective here. You see a green Charger coming at you. I don't know that stopping would be an answer if, and I'm not trying to litigate the case at all. I'm just saying that you would have to take some kind of evasive action, you would think, if you saw this car coming at you at a high rate of speed.
He said she didn't even attempt to stop. She just swerved. And so I guess the question comes down to, do you feel like she caused the crash by not trying to stop, instead swerving into oncoming traffic? There was a ditch on the other side. So her choice was to go into the ditch, go into oncoming traffic, or stop while this green Charger is coming at a high rate of speed toward her. Lacy did slam on his brakes and move back over and would not have collided with her. But the question is, from her perspective, what choice did she have? The witnesses on the scene said she had no choice. Matt Ory, the attorney for the Lacy family, is saying she could have just stopped and none of this would have ever happened.
And it is a tragedy in so many different ways, because Kyren Lacy went on to shoot himself after a domestic incident with his sister, right? Was this in Houston?
Correct. His sister had called police after they had an argument. She says he pulled out a gun, fired one round that went into the ground, and then got in his car and left. Police were trying to find him to arrest him because of this domestic incident with the discharge of a weapon. They say when they did catch up to him, he was already in the car with a bullet wound through his head.
And real quick, didn't the a little bit of the attorney kind of almost making it seem as though the state police didn't handle this correctly?
They are accusing the state police, and you can see the interviews, of coercing the witnesses to control the narrative that they were delivering about how the crash was caused. Again, you can see the full witness statements and read them from what we have posted at WWL.com.
Can you play that first soundbite again, Tim, if you can, please? Because this is what came from what, body cam video?
Yeah, the body cam video when the first trooper arrived on the scene and what the witnesses told him when he got there.
There's a green charger that caused all this. SRT8, he caused all this. He went to pay the funds way back there, sir.
The green charger collided with these cars?
He went right
between. He went around
that truck, okay?
He was passing up way
between her right now, and she had no choice.
There's no coercion there. That's just witnesses telling what they saw.
Right, but Ori says later in additional interviews, he accuses state police of influencing the statements from the witnesses to align with what those initial witnesses said. Again, you can see all of the witness interviews that Ori presented and state police have presented. All of that's in both of those videos that are the number one story on our website at WWL.com. It will be interesting to see how this goes because social media went crazy with the narrative from Ori and seemed many, many people on social media, the overwhelming posts I saw, seemed to believe that Lacey did not cause this crash after what Ori presented. Now we'll see how this additional video influences that public opinion.
And I know we have to go, but then it turned political, then it turned racial, and it was all about bad driving is what it's all about, I think. Anyway, we'll take a break, come back, talk about the Pelicans. Thank you, Dave. Go to WWL.com. Look at that video. We'll be back. All right, Tommy Tucker, 850, 10 till 9. Go to WWL.com and get in some texts on this. You can see that video the LSP, Louisiana State Police, released about Kyron Lacey, and you can make your own mind up on that. Ollie Cosell joins us now, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Talk about your New Orleans Pelicans. How you doing, Ollie?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
I am okay, sir. Tell me about the Pelicans and the performance they put on in Australia, down under, as they say.
Right. So they spent a week down there, played a couple preseason games against NBL, which is the Australian League. And they fared really well, especially in the second game. But what you wanted to see, right, wins and losses don't matter. They weren't trying to win, obviously. Zion Williamson didn't play in either second half of either game. Was the fact that he's healthy, he's moving great, he's looking as good as even he said it himself. He hasn't felt like this since college. So that's fantastic, right? Pelicans need that kind of leader, that one of the best players in the league, an all-NBA type. And then, of course, everybody else around them. They've got a lot of new faces, Tommy. Only 8 players returned from last season. So you wanted to see how one of their bigger acquisitions, Jordan Poole, looked, and he looked really good. And Trey Murphy looks like he's ready to be an all-star. And then, of course, the young guys, especially Jeremiah Fierce. How are they going to fit? Will Willie Green play them? And, again, it looks like the answer was yes, because he got all his run, plenty of run. He was the first player off the bench in that first game. And fared really well, despite the fact didn't make all the shots, right? Struggled a little bit, but he looks like a quality NBA type of player with the talent, even though he's 18. So there's a lot to be excited about. There's better depth. Looks like the leaders are going to actually lead the team in terms of Zion Williamson's now grabbed the mantle. And so we've got a couple more preseason games left. We'll have to see. A lot of experts, Tommy, don't like this team, the way it's been put together. But I think a lot of people here locally are actually a lot more excited about this team, especially based on what happened last year.
Yeah, I am. I am excited about it. Tell me about Sadiq Bey.
Yeah, so Sadiq Bey, everybody thought he was a throw-in when they acquired Jordan Poole from Washington, the trade that sent C.J. McCollum over to the Wizards. But look, he's not a throw-in. If anybody's followed his short career, he's a really good player. He started a lot of games up for the Detroit Pistons, had even a 50-point game. But the last couple of years, he's been derailed by a knee injury. And he finally stepped on the court. He hadn't played basketball in 18 months before finally playing here in Australia for the Pelicans. So it was good to see that he's moving well, right? Laterally, he's physically as fit as he says he's ever been. So he could be a very useful piece, as you saw, right? In the second game, he exploded for over 20 points, knocked down 4 threes. He took the place of Herb Jones in the starting lineup because Herb has had to miss a few games. But I'll tell you what, he's a quality player. Guy, they haven't had anybody like him since probably Najee Marshall a couple years ago. But he's even more qualified, right? He's got a better resume. So everybody's excited about him, too.
So Jose Alvarado got hurt?
No, Jose's fine. Okay. Jose's fine. He always seems to, you know, he takes a fall, hard fall, but it was nothing serious. He's going to be ready to go.
tell me about the next preseason game is what, in Birmingham? And then tell me about the season, how we get started here with the Pelicans.
Right. So next week on the 14th, the Pelicans will travel up to Birmingham. This has become a yearly thing where they hold a game up there for which is, of course, is the home of their G League team. Mm-hmm. So to get the fans excited about the NBA team in Birmingham, they'll face the Houston Rockets, who now have added Kevin Durant, who are considered to be one of the best teams in the Western Conference. So definitely tune into that game because you'll get a much better sense of how the Pelicans should fare against at least kind of very quality NBA opponents. After that, they'll play a couple of days later their final preseason game against the Orlando Magic in Orlando. And then the regular season, Tommy, it's not far away, a couple of weeks away. October 22nd is the first game.
Against the Grizzlies, how important is it that they get off to a quick start?
Oh, I think it's everything. Every year, seemingly, they start slowly, and you're wondering, is this going to be another year where either the wheels fall off or they're just struggling to stay around 500? They never seemingly start on top, and I don't think this year's going to be, honestly, that much different because the schedule's tough. First 7 out of their 10 games on the road, and there's just so many good teams, you know, for about the first 2 months or so of the schedule. So if they could stay around 500,
that's what I was
going to
say.
Huge, huge win.
That's what I was going to say. I swear to goodness, you took the words right out of my mouth. Ali, I'm looking at it and I'm thinking, you know, they play the Nets on December 6th. If you can be 500 at that point, you're in good position.
Yeah.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time as always. Ali Cosell, credentialed NBA writer covering the Pelicans. Of course, we'll have all the Pelicans games for you here on WWL. 856, 4 till 9. Traffic now, WWL. Thank you. And Ralph Brennan is nice enough to join us, and we talked to him for a while ago for an hour when Ian McNulty couldn't be in. But we've already, Ralph, you know, you listen, you know, we try to talk to victims of crime and try to tell the stories behind it because, for example, in this case, Carl Morgan was a sous chef. He was a carjacking victim, but he was a lot more than that, right? And that's what we try to I guess, tell a story behind.
Yes. In addition to being a very integral part of our culinary team at Brennan's, he has a young son who's about 2 years old. Mm. And everything you've been reading and hearing about him is that he really loved his son because we would do events in the restaurants, you know, for the staff, and he'd bring his son.
Mm.
And he would introduce him around and...
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. Now, I don't know if you've heard, but Mint's premium wireless is $15 a month. But I'd like to offer one other perk. We have no stores. That means no small talk.
Crazy weather we're having.
No, it's not. It's just weather. It is an introvert's dream. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan, $15 per month equivalent required. New customer offer, first 3 months only. Then full price plan options available. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
I need a job with a steady paycheck.
I need a job that offers health care on day one for me and my kids.
I want a job where I can get certified in technical roles, like robotics or software engineering.
In communities across the country, hourly Amazon employees earn an average of over $23 an hour with opportunities to grow their skills and their paycheck by enrolling in free skills training programs and apprenticeships. Learn more at aboutamazon.com.
You walk in tired and hungry, one bad dinner away from losing it. You don't like to cook. You don't want more takeout. You just want something good. That's why there's Dish by Blue Apron. Pre-made meals with at least 20 grams of protein and no artificial flavors or colors, from fridge to fork in 5 minutes or less. Keep the flavor. Ditch the subscription. Get 20% off your first two orders with code APRON20. Terms and conditions apply. Visit blueapron.com/terms for more.
You know, she was so proud and caring of him. Yeah, it's been really tough because Carl was such an outgoing guy, big guy, and very jovial. He loved what he did, and he was very proud of his son. And that's really been the hardest thing for me, I know, and many of our staff, to get our arms around it. It's such a random event.
I know this is, you know, Carl's story and not yours, but you are a part of it, and that's why I wanted to talk to you about this. Tell me, how did you find out about this?
I got a phone call from the general manager and our operations director and our executive vice president. I was not there at the time, and they called me and told me about it. Because they didn't want me to get it, you know, second, third hand or something, which is what the right thing is. And then we started gathering information as much as we could. We started to react to it. We tried to, you know, assess the situation of the staff. And, of course, they were very upset. We actually brought in some counselors to help them, grief counselors. We didn't know his wife well, or not really his wife, his partner, the mother of Silas. Right. And so we had to get to know her and begin to work with her on what we could do to support her, Silas, and maybe other family members in addition to our staff.
How is she doing?
I don't know. I don't know how you answered that question.
Yeah, I mean,
right,
it's a dumb question, I guess, in a way, Ralph. Well, but is as well as she can, I guess?
I guess so, yeah. Yeah. Yep. And, we, you know, we're trying to help the family out. Fried Chicken Festival was this past weekend, and that was his big deal. We don't usually do events like that. Mm-hmm. And Carl pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed because he would serve that chicken to our staff. And he was using a recipe of his grandmother's. And he said, look, this is good. If it's good enough for us, we ought to take it to the Fried Chicken Festival. And he loved cooking it for the staff. And so we said, okay. And we were so shocked, but we went ahead and did it. And because we're a family, and all kinds of people in our company stood up and helped execute his dream.
Tell me about his sandwich. I think he'd like people to know about it.
Yeah, it's a fried chicken sandwich, which sounds pretty simple, but he likes to use thighs. Mm-hmm. Which I happen to like.
I think it's the most flavorful part of the chicken, I think.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. He brines it in a buttermilk brine. He has some pickles that he makes himself.
Really?
Yes, and he works with our bakery. He has a sesame bun that he uses. And the sauce that they put on it has a crystal hot sauce in it. So that's
Sounds
another local
delicious.
Dish. Yep. And then, you know, they put some coleslaw on it that are made with serrano peppers. I'm trying to think. I guess that's about it. But he, you know, he cooks it and, like I said, serves it to the staff. And he said, if it's good enough for the staff and they love it, it's got to be good enough for everyone. And it'll show people we can do some things a little bit differently than we do, in the restaurant. Different quality, different levels of food.
Is that something that's on the menu or would be on the menu or not?
No,
really?
But could be.
Okay.
That's the talk right now.
Yeah.
I was talking with somebody about that yesterday, what we can do to honor him. And then to help him financially, we're donating the proceeds from the Fried Chicken Festival to him. Well, not to him, to his estate.
Right.
Or we're not sure yet. We're working with attorneys on how to set this up. Because
trust,
we also want to do
something
for his son long term, so he'll be able to go to school.
Does his son have any idea what happened?
I don't know. I don't know.
2 years old, right?
Yes, two years old. I mean, I'm thinking about, I have two grandchildren about that age. I don't know if they might notice. Maybe he notices something different. Something's different, probably.
Yeah. You know, the idea just popped into my head. If there would be some kind of way to have this sandwich served maybe for a weekend at every restaurant, and the proceeds from it go toward his family. I don't know if anything's like that even possible or practical or anything like that. But
no, but that's a great idea.
Is it?
I'm going to walk out of here.
All right. For the weekend, maybe make it like the Carl Morgan chicken sandwich weekend or something along those lines, and you could get it at every restaurant you go to and a portion of the proceeds, because it seems like something that just about every restaurant could do, right, if they had the...
Yes, they could. I'm going to have to work on this, because I'm getting a lot of calls and texts and emails from people all over this area who know us, obviously, but then I have friends in the industry all over, and they found out about it. I guess it's hit some sort of national media.
I saw it on the Today Show, as a matter of fact, today.
Oh, was it? Yeah. Okay. I know we did an interview on that recently.
Well, you have an iconic brand, first of all, right? Mm-hmm. So when something like that happens, it's going to make national news.
And everybody's saying, what can we do?
Yeah.
And I've said, hold on. We're working on it.
Mm-hmm.
He does have an insurance policy that we provide to all of our staff. And so that'll help them get started and get funeral arrangements made, et cetera. They're looking at a service in about 2 weeks on the 20th of October. He has some family out of town, and they've come in and they've started to work on it. We're not directly involved in that.
Part of it.
Yeah, that part, right. We're going to help them and support them in any way. We might do an event for them afterwards, a reception
or
afterwards.
Past, like, almost, yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did he come to work with Brennan's, Ralph?
That's a good question. I don't know that. He's been with us since 2020, and he's just slowly but surely worked his way up.
And as a sous chef, what is that? What does a sous chef do?
A sous chef's one of the really critical person, and I was thinking about this because I knew you might ask this question. And we've been talking a lot about the Saints.
Mm-hmm.
So we have an executive chef, and she's like the head coach.
Okay.
And we have four other sous chefs, and they do different things. And one of them is to run our private parties, which Carl did. And they're like the offensive coordinator, defensive coordinator, special teams coordinator. They all have responsibilities in the kitchen because the executive chef can't do it all. So they specialize in different areas, and we will move them around from different areas to give them more training and development. Mm-hmm. Carl's been in that position several years now. And just to give you some perspective, we probably do over 1,000 parties a year at Brennan's. Those can be anywhere from a party of six maybe, a business lunch or something that wants a private room, to a couple of hundred people for a wedding reception that uses the whole restaurant. And Carl would have been responsible for the food for all of those events. So you have to have a lot of flexibility in what you do.
I know you have a very family-oriented atmosphere. And I was telling you off the air, we took an Uber back from the show we did at the Presbyter on a Katrina anniversary. And the person at the time didn't know who I was or anything. And Jordan was with me. And we were talking. We passed your restaurant. And somehow it came to be that the Uber driver was talking about her relative that worked for you and what a nice guy you were, what a family atmosphere it was, and so forth. This has to be exceptionally hard on the staff, because not only do you have the personal sense of loss, but you got the professional loss as well, right? I mean, that's a big presence in the organization that's gone.
Yes, it is. From a professional standpoint, it is. Because Carl was talented. He, as I said, he had a lot of responsibility with over 1,000 parties, and that will be missed. We do have other team members who can step up and help him. But a restaurant's really a family, and that's the best way to be successful. I mentioned to you that we're in the people business. Mm-hmm. And so we try to take good care of our guests, but we also try to take good care of our staff. And, you know, we have, I don't know how many at Brennan's, 150 staff members maybe. And at the other restaurants, we have a comparable number of people. And everybody has issues. And so we try to help them when they get these issues that come up, and we because they're part of our team. And this is probably the worst that we've had to deal with. And somebody was killed.
Right. And I would think it's an ongoing process where every now and then a staff member, even though it's been how long now? I don't have the date in front of me, but it's almost like it seems surrealistic where it's like, well, wait a minute, I'm expecting Carl to walk in. And
right.
Yeah. Is it every day still?
Yeah, I think it is. I was there yesterday. It's been about a week. Yeah. I purposely walked upstairs and went to the party kitchen, which was his hangout, just to, because he, that's where I used to communicate with him. You know, he was always up there. We'd go talk a little bit. He was always sticking food in front of me to try. He was proud of what he did. And, you know, there was something missing. And he will be missed. I mean, they told me that they want to put his picture up. This is coming up through the staff to put his picture in the kitchen, in the party kitchen. We have two different kitchens, one for private events and then one for a la carte dining. And they want to put his picture up. So I think that's quite a compliment to Carl.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. We're talking to Ralph Brennan about the loss of Carl Morgan, the sous chef, who was killed in the senselessly killed in a carjacking, and subsequently the carjacker himself was killed. They don't know what went on with that yet. It just seems like so many ways the system failed in so many different things, and unfortunately you got a man who was a good father, a very productive member of society, good partner by all accounts, and is just gone senselessly. We'll pick it up. We come back. 921 WWL. And Ralph Brennan, you can trust him too, 930. He's with us talking about Carl Morgan, the sous chef that was senselessly killed while picking up his son from daycare during a carjacking, and the perpetrator subsequently was killed, so there will be no trial or anything. I guess there's still an investigation that'll go on to see who killed the perpetrator. But I wanted to focus more on Carl Morgan because, you know, Ralph, so many times, and I was telling you this off the air, we hear about a crime, and then something else knocks it off of our radar, right? Something either personally or something in the news. And all Carl gets remembered as, oh, he's a guy, and I don't mean this disrespectfully at all, but oh, he's a guy that got that Brennan's chef that got killed in a carjacking. But he was so much more than that, right? And that's why I invited you today to talk about him. And you talked about the time that y'all would hang out together. Was he a funny guy? Did he like to joke around? Was he passionate about his cooking? What?
Yes and yes. I mean, he was a great guy. I mean, he's a big kind of, burly may not be the right adjective.
But teddy bear kind of guy?
Yeah, a little bit like a teddy bear. And he really loved what he did. He ran that party kitchen. And so, you know, when I would visit him, he always had a smile on his face. He was always proud of his food. If we ever had a problem that a dish wasn't done correctly, fixed it right away. Didn't take it personally because he was a true professional. And but also he was always trying to improve and get better.
They're washing windows, and on the eighth floor, you're not necessarily used to people knocking on a window on the eighth floor. You presume something's going wrong, so if you hear noise in the background, that's what's happening. I'm sorry, Ralph, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but it was there, and I thought I'd address it.
Yeah, but no, he was really proud of what he did, and, you know, he was really responsible for a lot of what Brennan's does in private events, and he was very proud of that.
Tell me what that means when you say he was the party chef. Is that what you said?
Yes. So a sous chef, you know, works under the executive chef, who's like a head coach. Mm-hmm. He's like an offensive coordinator or a defensive coordinator because he has that responsibility of taking care of the parties, and he handles over 1,000 parties a year.
So he had a lot of people working with him.
He had
as
a team
well,
working with him, and he was responsible for them. And the parties were all different sizes. And, you know, he was always proud because he had an opportunity to do a variety of food and for a variety of meals, from sit-down dinners to buffets to just cocktail receptions and things like that. But he was always proud of what he did. And you could see that come through, especially because when he was with his son, he was proud of his son. And he had that same jovial spirit that I think really made a difference in the kitchen environment that he worked in, because he was well respected by all of the culinary staff and certainly the service team also. And he was easy to work with our party staff and, our party sales team. So, I mean, he's just a wonderful person. And, you know, that's what this business is all about. I've said it before. It's all about people. And so that his attitude was infectious.
So take me through, if you can, Carl's workday. He would come in on a typical day and do what? He'd see what's scheduled, what plan ahead, see what's booked, and then make sure that the food was there and would be cooked and all that stuff?
Yes. Okay. That's basically what he did. I mean, in that position, you always have to be thinking ahead to make sure that you have all the product that you need. And the parties vary. They vary in number on a given day.
As small as or as large as?
And then as small as large as, maybe some special requests. So he was constantly planning ahead to get ready for events coming up. And so he would come in, and he would know what's coming in today because he'd already looked at it the day before or his last day before he went off for a couple of days. And then he has a team, and he assigned them responsibilities, and off they'd go. Sometimes we had early morning breakfast, for example, and he might not actually come in for that, but you know, his team was there to execute it. Then he'd come in and do the dinner parties because he was a leader. And like I said, like a defensive or offensive coordinator, it was his responsibility to take care of that team and to execute the guest requests.
Seems like he took a lot of pride in what he did, real quality control kind of guy.
Oh, yeah. Lots of pride. Lots of pride. And always a smile on his face. He was a happy, happy person.
You said he was putting food in front of you all the time. Was he an inventive kind of guy or what, creative?
Yeah, inventive. And sometimes he would just give me something that they were cooking for a party to taste. Because, you know, he knows I like to walk through kitchens and taste. Mm-hmm. So he'd have something. He wouldn't know I was coming, but he'd have something there he would give me. Or sometimes I'd say hello and talk to the kitchen and then leave, and I'd come back upstairs a little bit later, and there was something waiting for me because he was proud of what he did.
When he didn't talk about food, what did he like to talk about?
Ooh, Silas, his son.
Yeah.
Yeah, life. He was just a jovial, good-hearted spirit. I'm trying to think. I don't know if he was a sports fan or not. Some of the kitchens, you know, sports are a big deal.
Right.
And I talk sports with him, but not Carl.
When you talked about he took a lot of pride, I guess he took a lot of pride in his chicken sandwich. Was there anything else, any other specialties that he really liked?
I am not sure of that.
Okay. I thought he might have said, hey, Ralph, take a taste of this. See what you think of this. Is my grandmother's that or the other thing?
No, I don't remember him specifically saying that, but he would always give me, like I said, things to taste, things to try. You know, he would work hard on trying to improve his party menus so that the guest would be happy with, you know, the food we were putting in front of him, serving him.
You're a community leader. I don't think that's a stretch to say that. We'll talk about the whole carjacking thing and the system and everything else when we come back, all right? Because I just want to look at that from the macro level as well. We're talking to Ralph Brennan about the loss of Carl Morgan, a father of a two-year-old that was just killed in a tragic carjacking, and we'll continue the conversation when we come back. 9:36, 24 till 10, traffic now, WWL. 9:44, 16 till 10. Everybody wants to come in and say hi to Ralph Brennan when they know that he's in the studio because he's a very nice guy. Ralph, I was talking to you earlier about, and look, it's far too soon to talk about good things coming out of this, but I guess in a way, is there anything at this point you can see positive coming out of this that Carl would have said, well, you know what, I'm sorry that my life was taken from me. Lord knows I don't want to leave my partner behind. I don't want to leave my son behind, but at least this, can you think of anything at all?
That's a great question. Carl and I never talked about that much.
But even among maybe in the restaurant that you saw,
Well, I mean, I think overall he would, as jovial as he was, as much as a people person he was, he'd want to make sure that everyone was as safe as possible to be in this community. You know, in his role in our company, he didn't deal with that. That's more the kind of things that I deal with. But I think would, if he had to get something good, it would be to reverse some of the situations that we have in this community. Because obviously, you know, he's leaving his son and his significant other. You know, he's been taken away from them senselessly, in my opinion. And, you know, that's so unfortunate that, you know, this, and I focused on the kids. I've said before that I've always spent a lot of time focusing on kids, my grandchildren, et cetera. But also in the community, I was a longtime member of the Children's Hospital Board, and I've done some other activities with kids. And because I think the kids are so important. You know, that there was that song, I can't remember the name of it, but the children are our future, and they are. And that's why we need to give them the best education that we can, give them the best opportunities to grow in this community, to work in this community. You know, one of the things you've seen lately, and this has been happening, though, for a long time, is people exiting the community and moving to other places. We need to give them an opportunity and, more importantly, a reason to stay here, because it's a wonderful, wonderful city. You know, I always say we've been really lucky, because it's the culture that brings people here. It's the culture that people love, especially visitors. But those of us who live here and stay here, I think we embrace that culture. And I say we're lucky because we're in the food business, and food is one of the pieces to our culture here, like music is, like history, like architecture. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, but and it's, you know, they use the phrase culture bearers, but I think sometimes people don't realize that it's not a machine, or a faucet, you can't turn it on and turn it off. You got to realize that there are people that provide these services, provide right. This music, that provide the food, etc., and you can't revel in that and then look the other way when something needs to be done or they have a need. And I always go back, Ralph, to, you know, you and me and whomever are born at Baptist Hospital, and we're in our little bassinets there, and we're all equal at that point, right? I mean, everybody's got the little cap on, the little blanket. We're all right. Swaddled up. But at some point, things happen in life where we go divergent paths. And if you want to, you know, look at Carl, and if you want to look at the criminal that took his life, who is now deceased, at some point, I don't know about age, but just for argument's sake, they were lying side by side in a bassinet, right? So at what point did Carl... What led to Carl being the successful man that he was, the nice man that he was, and what was it that led to the criminal that took his life taking the road that he took?
Yeah.
Is that too philosophical or not? Do you understand?
Yes.
That drives me crazy.
I understand what you're saying. I'm not smart enough to have an answer for
that.
Yeah,
but also about the culture bearer part of it, too, where you can't embrace the culture of New Orleans, and then I don't want to get anybody mad here. I'm going to use my words carefully, but... And then run to the suburbs and then think that everything's going to be okay and not realize that there are people behind that culture. Make sense?
Yes. Yes.
And I know you do. That's. I guess I'm preaching to the choir on this one.
Yeah. I think, you know, one of the most important things that we can do is educate our people who live in our community. Mm-hmm. I grew up with a father who, because of World War II, didn't have a chance to complete college. And as his first son, I was going to college. And he pushed me and pushed me and pushed me to go to school, and I did. And I think that made him very happy. You know, it doesn't give you all the answers, but right. It gives you opportunities to figure out the answers. So, education and healthcare are just, to me, side by side. And I'm sorry, I'm getting to... A point where I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, I'm just picking your brain. Healthcare. You know what? There is no question, Ralph. I'm just picking your brain. That's all.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the way I've always tried to operate. We, you know, one of our core values at the company is called personal and professional growth. And what I mean by that is that a year from now, you need to be better. And everyone's different, so we don't have any rules. But, you know, we need to provide you some training. You may need to provide some training for yourself. You know, we need to give you the opportunity to grow as a staff member.
All you can give is opportunity, correct?
Right. Yes. Yeah. Yep. And fortunately, in our company, we have a lot of people who take that opportunity to grow. And we just had a manager retire from Ralph's on the Park And I say Ralphson's Park because that's where he's been for his last tenure with us. But he's moved around in all of our restaurants for 23 years. He's been with us. And he retired. And he'd worked previously for some other restaurants before he joined us. And so we have a lot of people with long-term tenure because we give them that opportunity to grow and learn. And I think that's important because we talked earlier about the people business. That's what we're all about. And people are our most important asset.
And we're running out of time here, but if there's one thing you can take away from this, I would think you would take some solace in that Carl loved what he did and he loved where he was doing it and you were a part of that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we want to be. I mean, we want to help people grow and develop. And, you know, I pride myself. I've been around a long time now that we have a lot of people who have been with us a long time. And,
but it's not just them. It's their kids, right? And that's what people mm-hmm. that don't own businesses don't realize, that it's not just mom and daddy that depend on you. It's mom and daddy, and in this case, young Silas, that was depending on you and still right. will, because I know you could take care of him.
Yeah, we are. We are. But you're right. I mean, it's because, you know, just like they're a family, we're a family. And, you know, we try to take care of our teams. And you know, things come up throughout the years. I mean, Carl's unfortunate situation is probably the most extreme that we've dealt with because of the nature of what happened. But we do get staff members who need help throughout the year, and we work with them in different ways. And they're different issues that we need to deal with, and we try to deal with it as best we can and help them out because they represent us.
You know, I think I'm trying to say, my own clumsy way, is that if we as a society could figure it out, as have you, as a businessman or as so many other businessmen or business people or entrepreneurs have done, I think we'd be a lot better off.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ralph, for coming in. I'm sorry about your loss. I really am, man. It's terrible.
Thank you very much.
And look, I know you're going to have some other things coming up for Carl. The microphone's open whenever you want it. All right.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
All right, we'll take a break, come back, find out what Newell's got today. He's got a big day planned with three sheriff's candidates coming in, I think, here on WWL.
Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $200 into something bigger when you bet on Moneyline, Spread, Totals, Player Props.
$200 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In app only.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
To remind you that 60% of sales on Amazon come from independent sellers, here's John from Devil Dog Pet Company.
We run our family business from Sterling Heights, Michigan, but we can reach customers all over the country thanks to Amazon. Good boy.
Shop small business on Amazon.
It's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's
outside
not,
of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of Browns.
You know
Browns
why it's not coming from those guys?
Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos.
Maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.